This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So it's all Trump's fault.
He did it.
Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot, triple threat, as we know her here Tuesday, blamed Trump for the impasse between the city's public school system and the teachers union. Help me connect the dots.
Okay.
So look, this is a very difficult situation, and we're in it still because of the incompetence of the previous administration. So I think it's important for both sides to come to the table in good faith, recognize that we're both trying to work through a very challenging situation, but we must get a deal done.
I mean, torn right out of the Democratic playbook, if things are going bad, blame the Republicans, blame President Trump for a lack of vaccines, because, you know, the teachers say, Dan, that they want to get vaccinated before they go back to school. Not just one vaccination, but two now.
Yeah, well, you know, I understand common enemy. Hey, you know, we're both on the same side here against Trump, and Trump has put us in this position. So I won't blame you. You don't blame me. We all blame bad orange man. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Follow up, was he also responsible for the strike 15 months ago, 16 months ago?
Yeah, right, I'm sure. I mean, she just empowered the union even more because she gave them, you know, she gave herself a scapegoat. So it's not my fault, union. Look, it's orange man's fault.
And but for orange man, what would have been in place that is not currently in place? Everybody would have been vaccinated. Is that her
theory? That's her point of contention. Yeah.
So everybody would have been vaccinated, even though she and her ilk, her ideological fellow travelers, her fellow Democrat socialists, all of their handmaids in the media laughed, ridiculed, said not true that we were going to have a vaccine by the end of the year. So Operation Warp Speed was a joke to them. President Trump was never going to be able to deliver a vaccine by the end of the year. And they were not. That was a claim that was rejected by the Washington Post fact checkers and all of the others. Pish posh. We don't believe that. Orange man deliver. So that occurred. And now we assume, oh, well, that was always going to occur. And the distribution, which at the time President Biden took office, was running at the clip that President Biden is now promising over the next 100 days. I mean, just forget even the ridiculousness of the charge of blaming the president for a labor impasse at the local level. Just even forget that. Just walk through the claim and the premises they're based on. If anybody in the D.C., I mean, so the Chicago Press Corps, which, of course, is just a D.C. outlet, if any of them there had any courage whatsoever or the ability to connect any dots, you just walk back. Oh, it's the vaccines, because all the teachers would have been vaccinated. Then we wouldn't have had, and the kids, too, apparently, there were clinical trials on kids under the age of 16. But that would have happened, too. But for
they want them for 16 and over. That's why they're not starting high school, because some high school.
Well, excuse me.
But it has nothing to do with Trump.
Well, they're not starting grade school.
Right. You're right. Yeah. I don't know. Baby steps we should start with. You know, we did have preschool and special ed for 3 weeks. No reports of any cases. Well, there was one assistant principal in a school that had two kids. And that was it.
You know,
it was a success. And they know it. The CTU knows it. Those thugs know it. And they don't care about the science and the data. They care about power only.
You know whose fault this really is? It's the fault of the same Chicagoan who ruined the game of basketball.
Maybe it's my fault. Maybe I led you to believe it was easy when it wasn't. Maybe I made you think my highlights started at the free throw line and not in the gym. Maybe I made you think that every shot I took was a game winner. That my game was built on flash and not fire. Maybe it's my fault that you didn't see that failure gave me strength, that my pain was my motivation. Maybe I led you to believe that basketball was a God-given gift and not something I worked for every single day of my life. Maybe I destroyed the game. Or maybe You're just making excuses.
So Michael Jordan is to blame or Donald Trump? He created these expectations. First, he destroyed basketball by making us think things that weren't true. And then, I don't know. I mean, is there any way we can fold him into this to make him for making us believe things about COVID that weren't true, like Lori Lightfoot?
Well, that might be a bit of a stretch. But the problem, I mean, she was on MSNBC the day before, and she called the situation in Chicago uniquely local. And then less than 24 hours.
Maybe she should call the situation for it to come to Chicago.
Yeah. Well, then the next day, less than 24 hours, it's Trump's fault. And then she won't even, she refuses to talk to the local media. So she's not had a press conference. She has nothing scheduled for today either.
So it's interesting because in California, there doesn't seem to be much focus on Trump. There's a lot of focus on Gavin Newsom. You know, they have this recall effort afoot. They got to get 1.5 million signatures by March 17th. But they're moving in that direction. It's really grassroots generated. There's not really a paid program going on for the signature gathering. You have a former mayor of San Diego named Kevin Falconer, who has announced that he will be a candidate if the recall is triggered. He's raised $1 million so far, which I know is chump change in California, but it's a start. And there was this really interesting interview in Slate so this is from the left, which is why I find this interesting. You know, what does the left think about Gavin Newsom? Are they rallying to his defense? Do they think he's vulnerable? Is this a real thing? So this interview was with a woman named Angela Hart, who is a health policy wonk for California Healthline. And she had some very telling things to say about the seriousness of this recall effort. She said, among other things, I'm always trying to gut check myself about if this is a long shot. And I went out to a lot of my Democratic sources, and I did not hear anybody with a full-throttle defense of the governor and his leadership. I did not hear anybody say this is not a Gavin Newsom problem. And she goes on to say that the French Laundry dinner, you know, his moment of hypocrisy, like Lori Lightfoot, face of the city, getting her hair cut, her moment of hypocrisy, that was really a watershed moment in California, not so much in Chicago or Illinois. Doesn't work here, but it works in California, which is on paper seemingly a more left state, but maybe not in practice. She said of that, Ms. Hart, in this interview in Slate, I've heard it everywhere. I've heard it from Republicans. I've heard it from independents. I've heard it from Democrats. It's optics, but it's deeper than that. Everybody has sacrificed so much. We've been, by and large, locked in our houses for the better part of a year, and to see the governor flippantly ignoring his own rules really hit a nerve. And now, what has he done? He's turned over the vaccine distribution to Blue Shield in California.
Right. Well, because he couldn't handle it.
Well, right. But that calls the question, why weren't you prepared? Why couldn't you handle it? Now, how much are we going to pay for Blue Shield to administer it? Because our state government couldn't competently do it. So I'll tell you what, it's fascinating to watch whether Gavin Newsom could be, you know, Gray Davis 2.0.
That would be great. Too bad we can't do that here.
Well, there's something afoot here. And my point is about all the great Davis or the Gavin Newsom as an example. Boy, if there's a reckoning for him in California, political reckoning, if he doesn't survive 2021 when he was supposed to be, you know, on the short list for 2024 and beyond.
Right.
That would be something. There has to be a political reckoning somewhere to send the message to the lockdowners that, number one, you're going to pay for the terrible decisions you made. And number two, you're not going to be able to paper over it by blaming bad orange man.
Well, and then, too, what about Pritzker? I mean, his French Laundry moment is the fact that his wife and daughter don't even live in the state that he rules. They haven't been here for months. And there's no plans of them coming back anytime soon because she has freedoms down there. So does his wife. They live in a free state where they can work out without masks on. She can go do her sports that she loves and compete and never stop doing that. When he put a moratorium, he halted travel sports. It's bad enough he took away high school sports, but then did the travel sports.
Yeah, and so?
So why can't we do something like that to him here? Does our state constitution not allow it?
Well, I mean, it doesn't. We don't have the same ballot initiative protocols that California does. We have a recall law, but it's very high barter to clear. You're not going to clear it. But that's sort of a secondary issue. The question of what's the outlet for the revolt is the question in California, and they have recall. The question here is there a revolt that needs an outlet?
I mean, are Democrats really satisfied with what these neophyte politicians are doing, Lightfoot and Pritzker? Are they?
I don't see a revolt looking for an outlet here the way that you do see it in California. And that's a sad commentary in Illinois, isn't it? Or am I being too cynical?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
Mary at Midway.
Oh, hi. You know what? One thing Ms. Lightfoot did figure out, wasted no time. I'm looking out my window yesterday. I live by Midway. I'm lucky to have a garage. I didn't have to deal with this, but I have gotten tickets for it. Now you have to have a sticker in your car. It could be the permanent one or the everyday one. People are snowed in. People are iced in. I'm glad they did the roads, but that pushed a lot of cars in even worse. I saw my neighbors trying to get out. They have their cars there for extra days. Tickets were being given yesterday.
Oh, yeah. We need money.
The people, and I couldn't help but think of Sean from Elmwood Park, because you're right, it was XXX neon yellow vests going down the street, and I saw more than one being written. I thought, I know those people tried to get their cars out. Jesus, against the law, they didn't change a... Maybe it was a visitor. I mean, they wasted no time with that.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mary. We always get ours. You know, we eat first.
There you go. We're always first in line.
Jim in Crown Point.
It wouldn't be so bad for the governor of California or New York, but Florida is killing it. Indiana is operating. These are all Republican places, so you have a comparison. They have no excuses. None of them are on drugs, so it has to be incompetence that they're doing. Also, they lost 20 million vaccinations.
Yeah, they're looking for them.
Are they under the couch?
They got top men on that, Jim. Top men.
That could have gone to the CTU, and then they could have shut their mouths and gone back to school. That was 20 million.
No, it shouldn't go to CTU ever. No, I'm sorry. Hold on a second.
All right.
No, it should absolutely not go to teachers or the teachers union. There is no way they should be put to the front of the line. And you're paying an extortionist. What are you, nuts?
Well, they did it in Evanston and Skokie School District and at private schools. They brought the vaccines to the schools and vaccinated the teachers and the staff.
I'm sorry.
I don't know. I want them to stop biatching.
Is that responsive to my point? It's not.
So you don't think teachers should get vaccinated?
If you want to pay extortionists, then you pay extortionists. But we have a difference of opinion on that.
All right. Well, 3,700 have been vaccinated so far.
Employees.
Right. But I'm an employee. I could go to this place on diversity, they told me. But I'm not doing it because my mom's going to get vaccinated first, and then I'll get vaccinated.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Mike in Plano.
Hey, guys. Switching gears for a moment. You know, one thing that disappoints me is with everything going on, you have Republican leadership in Congress going out of their way to attack their own freshman congresswoman, Marjorie Taylor Greene, over what amounts to be thought crimes and conspiracy theories. Now, the Jewish space lasers thing, I'd never even heard of that until Carl Rove said it on TV. And the QAnon thing, the only people who keep talking about that are establishment politicians, the news media, and then not just them, you have... Outside the political world, Vice Channel's doing a documentary on him. There's a local sports show host named Dan Bernstein. You might have heard of him. Super liberal guy.
He constantly brings
him up. So my question is, why are these people in these such esteemed positions going out of their way to talk about what they say is a right-wing fringe group?
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mike.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Do I have to choose to have the Republican Party defined by Liz Cheney from Wyoming or Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia? Do we have to make this some sort of litmus test for membership, whether or not you support Liz Cheney's removal as the number three in the House Republican caucus, whether you do or do not support Marjorie Taylor Greene being stripped of her committee assignments and otherwise muzzled and put in the corner with the dunce cap as is being demanded?
Stephen Kinged,
yes. Right. Not the
horror
novelist.
The congressman from Iowa. Yeah. They put him in a room with some construction paper and crayons and said, here you go.
I think that's how Stephen King became such a creepy horror novelist, the other Stephen King, actually. So you better be careful.
Okay.
Liz Cheney or Marjorie Taylor Greene, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. The Wall Street Journal opined on the topic, sort of trying to offer Solomonic advice to the Republican caucuses. Leave Liz Cheney alone, and let's see how Marjorie Taylor Greene behaves as a member of Congress rather than making a final determination on her based on her previous, in many cases, idiotic social media posts.
And she's only a month in, folks. I mean, she's a newbie.
So the other thing, of course, the Wall Street Journal points out is the hypocrisy coming from the Democrat caucus that otherwise indulges the Ilhan Omars and the Maxine Waterses of the world who intermittently offer encouragement to violence and anti-Semitism and other such evils. So what should be done? You want to force Liz Cheney out of House Republican leadership for her vote, or do you want to let Wyoming voters make their decision on their congressman?
And what are people?
You want to strip Marjorie Taylor Greene of any committee assignments, or do you want to let the folks in her district in Georgia make that determination? You know, there's a lot of goofballs in Congress. I don't know if you've noticed.
Yeah, there's a lot of members of Congress. Yeah. And so you're going to have some goofy ones. You're going to have some bad apples, and you're going to have some strange people. But I wonder what's going to happen to Adam Kinzinger, our congressman here in Illinois. Is there going to be any backlash against him?
I don't know. As I said yesterday when we talked about it briefly, his latest video where he talks in theory about convictions and principles without ever getting to what exactly his convictions and principles are, other than being opposed to Marjorie Taylor Greene and President Trump. So there is some scuttlebutt afoot that some of the county organizations within his district, like LaSalle and Winnebago and Grundy, may move to censure him. You know, pass a resolution to express their displeasure. The same thing happened in Wyoming, but I have not heard a candidate that will challenge him. I have not heard, you know, any finality with respect to any sort of public denunciation of his public denunciations and his vote for impeachment. Lindsey Graham, Mitch McConnell getting into the act. Lindsey Graham, I believe Rep. Cheney is one of the strongest and most reliable conservative voices in the Republican Party. She's a fiscal and social conservative. No one works harder to ensure that her military is well prepared. Really? I mean, why? You know, it seems to me when you have
friends
this
with her father.
Well, it seems to me that you have this intramural squabble about these two members of Congress, then you're sort of playing the left's game. Liz Cheney, and by the way, Liz Cheney and Marjorie Greene both suffer from the same problem. Both of them were way over the top saying things that they had no basis to say. Liz Cheney with respect to Trump's alleged incitement to violence, and Marjorie Taylor Greene with respect to a lot of things on social media.
And you don't go after children on social media, sorry.
Go after children?
Well, the Parkland survivor.
What did she do?
Well, she was chasing him down the street and saying that, you know, he's trying to take away her Second Amendment rights, which she has a right, you know, to freedom of speech as well, but just would not go after kids. Not good. That did not sit well with me.
Uh-huh. Well,
I'm just telling you how I feel. I mean, I saw that and I went.
Yeah. Well, David Hogg was not just this random kid. He is a gun banning activist, isn't he? And he's not a kid either. He's an adult.
Right. Well, at the time, wasn't he 17?
I don't have the timeline of how old he was when Marjorie Taylor Greene had whatever interaction she had with him. He is a public figure acting as a gun banning activist, but he's off limits.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Uh-huh. He was old enough to be cause celeb on CNN and among the left generally. old enough to get, didn't he get early admission to Harvard? Oh, he's old enough for that, but he's not old enough to take criticism for his position on the Second Amendment. I love that position. Just like little Greta. She's just a child, but it's okay that all the adults use her to play the sentimental barbarians game to advance their illegitimate cause. But what she's doing and what's happening, how she's being used, that's off limits because she's a kid. No, I don't think so. Jim in Sheboygan, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, so a couple of things. David Hogg did get into Harvard early, and I believe he got a scholarship for it because he was an activist. Number two, I tried to get on Kingsinger's website yesterday to tell him my displeasure with him as a Republican, and I couldn't get in because I didn't have a zip code that conformed to his area. So
really?
I couldn't email him. I couldn't email him, so that was disappointing.
I'm
in favor of what they're doing in Wyoming and Phoenix and basically the locals talking to their representatives and centering them locally. But let's not play the national game with, you know, what the Dems are doing. NPR had a story the other day about all these people leaving the Republican Party in all these key states and everything. So let's not play their game. If the locals want to censure their representatives and call them on the carpet for their votes on impeachment, yes. But let's not do the national Democratic playbook.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Jim. Yeah, the other thing, too, is Liz Cheney, if she was removed as the chairman of the House Republican Conference, number three in leadership, if she was removed and there's a movement afoot to remove her, that is not canceling her, as the dopey Frank Luntz tweeted out. I had this exchange. I didn't have an exchange. I just picked up something that Norm Ornstein, this is a bit esoteric, probably most people don't know who this guy is, but he's just this longtime hack. He's this fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He holds himself out as some sort of center-right economist. He is neither of those things. But he tweeted out an old letter of Milton Friedman when Milton Friedman was, who is an economist and a Nobel Prize winner, when he was at the Hoover Institution. Friedman sent a letter to the American Enterprise Institute basically saying, what are you guys doing by having Norm Ornstein on your team? He undermines the position of advancing free minds, free markets, and a free society, which he does. And Norm Ornstein says, gosh, I sure glad I wasn't canceled back then. That's not canceling. That is somebody who has no authority over you at a different think tank sending a missive to his friends at another think tank saying, you know, this Norm Ornstein guy sucks. That's an opinion. And if it were me, I wouldn't have him on my team. That's an opinion. That's not being canceled. And removing Liz Cheney from leadership because a majority of the caucus, if that comes to pass, says I don't want her to be in leadership of our caucus because she doesn't represent the majority of the caucus's view on impeachment, and she did so spectacularly, and it harms the brand of the caucus or whatever their opinion is, that is not canceling her. She's still a member of Congress. She still can speak on the House floor. She still votes. She still goes home. She still can run for election. She can still do anything she wants. That is not canceling. Disagreeing is not canceling. Criticizing is not canceling. So let's just make that clear, because canceling is going to be used like bullying, which is right. Every time everything is bullying. And so then the word loses all meaning, as bullying has. Jim in Warrenville.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
You know, there's a big difference. There's a big difference between being in a leadership position like Liz Cheney and being from an obscure southern state. If you recall, we had that great congressman.
Georgia's an obscure southern state, but okay, all right.
Well, it is, because obviously they didn't carry the vote, they didn't pick up the banner and bring us across the finish line. So as far as I'm concerned, that's just like another one. That's like Johnston that thinks Guam is going to tip over if too many people to get one side of the island. Nobody wanted to censure him. Omar hates America. Nobody wants to censure her. Maxine Waters is absolutely insane, and nobody wants to censure her. But I can understand why you want to get rid of Liz Cheney. I also have some strong feelings about Kinzinger, and I wished I lived in his district so I could vote against him because I think he's a classic example of an Illinois rhino. Republicans in the state that are Republican in name only, and right. We got so many of them in Springfield collecting checks.
Thanks for the call, Jim. I appreciate it. By the way,
Adam did start a new super PAC, and isn't he using money from the left, from the Lincoln Project that was left over, taking those for his new super PAC?
I don't know if the Lincoln Project has contributed to his Country First PAC or whatever he's calling it. I think that's what he's calling it, but I have no idea. But point of order, the House did vote to condemn anti-Semitism generally after Omar's string of anti-Semitic comments. So they made a general condemnation of anti-Semitism without, you know, that was, you know, basically a proxy for condemning Omar, but they didn't want to condemn Omar. Point is this: yes, should the Republican Party self-police, and you know, and do you have to sometimes rein in members of the party and say, you know, that's not appropriate or that's not representative of our viewpoint on things, or I disagree with that other Republican, no matter what it is. Yeah, sure, we should self-police. A Republican Party that doesn't self-police, that doesn't hold itself to any particular standard, goes away. That's also part of the story of the Illinois Republican Party, which doesn't exist anymore, except in theory and in the minds of some people milling about, pretending they're going to compete for statewide office here. But you also have to let people say crazy things. Why are people so afraid of people saying crazy things? And then just trying to QAnon, repeat, like a magic incantation, that person will just explode before your very eyes. If it's so crazy, why are you concerned about it? If it's untrue, why are you so concerned about it? You don't think it's going to be fleshed out in the process of daily discourse? I mean, the people who are afraid of people saying unhinged things and use that as the predicate to shut people down who they disagree with, and that's what they're doing. Number one, they're being disingenuous. Number two, they don't trust you. They don't trust you to process fact from fiction. They don't trust you to be intellectually curious. They don't trust you to be able to distinguish somebody who is making a cogent argument, even though I might come to a different conclusion, versus somebody who is howling at the moon. They just don't trust you. The person who says ban, silence, banish is the person who has no confidence in their own beliefs and even less confidence in you. Tom in Blue Island.
Dan and Amy, good morning. Boy, Dan, you hit on just like three or four big points in the last 5 minutes, and Amy as well. Amy, you mentioned David Hogg. That guy is a political activist, and you actually took up the sword of the left there when you said, oh, well, you shouldn't be going after kids. Amy, it's the left that's using David Hogg. They're using him because of what he went through at Parkland. Did you ever think you'd see a day, Dan, when the left would actually sidle up next to a Cheney? How people can't understand how the left uses their enemies. Their enemies, as the one phone caller said, maybe two or three back, and I know, Dan, you're not on board with this, and I'm not. You have to fight them in the sewer, and I'm not saying do what they do, but this Marjorie Greene, she may be a whack job, but as you said, Dan, she's only there for 2 years. If she is that repugnant, her voters will have her gone. I what is it, Dan? What is even the method they're saying she has to be done? What are they going to do? I mean, are you going to drag her out in chains or something?
Yeah,
it's really crazy, guys.
If they could, thanks for the call, Tom. By the way, on the whole kid thing, you'll note for the record that the left had no problem going after Kyle Kashev, also a Parkland survivor, because he was pro-Second Amendment, and he responded to David Hogg. Bob in Edison Park.
Yeah, guys, you know, my point would be this. People like Adam Kinzinger and Cheney, where were they if they're so vocal about things that they see are wrong, where were they when the cities were burning, when in flames, BLM, Antifa? Where were they when Kamala Harris was bailing these people out who were doing this? They were nowhere to be heard. So my point is, they are not like pragmatists as far as finding what's right. They are strictly tools of the left, and actually worse than the left, because they are the wolf of sheep's clothing.
Thanks for the call, Bob. Here's what it is, too. I mean, the pronouncements from some of these politicians, particularly here, I mean, the Republicans, they just frankly, many in D.C., Lindsey Graham's a good example. They reek of one of two things, ambition or fear. And the two are sort of connected, but I'll save that digression for a later time. But doesn't it just reek of ambition or fear? This is my opportunity to pierce through and get some additional profile. Or I'm afraid. So I'll make some sort of like kindergarten pro forma statement about being opposed to violence, as if that's really important because, God, look, I have a lapel pin. So it's me saying it. So now people understand that violence is bad. I mean, it's just so tiresome. God, they're such navel-gazing simpletons. I can't believe anybody listens to them, actually. Some of these people. Pete and Racine.
Good morning. See, I've sat on several boards through the years, and the head of that board would say, I don't want yes men. I want you to vote the way you feel, and I want your input. And that's a pathetic thing about both Republican and Democrat. They 100% vote yes or 100% vote no. There's no one that has the intestinal fortitude to vote the way they feel and how they feel that they are informed. And that's pathetic. I'd like to see a vote sometime that was 95 to 120, you know, where people are voting the way they honestly feel. It's just ridiculous that they don't have the guts to vote the way they feel or the way they are informed that they should. About a particular subject that they're voting on.
Right. Thanks for the call. We elect people in the truest sense of representative republic. You elect people for their judgment, not to be weather vanes. If we were going to elect weather vanes, we don't need human beings. We can just have a plebiscite in every vote. Frank in Franklin Park.
Yeah, I don't get this cancel and silencing culture. I was always taught that if an idiot wants to speak, you give them the microphone. Let them show their true colors. So if the right is so bad and such racist and such white supremacist, we should be allowed to speak so we could show our true colors.
Exactly. Thanks, Frank.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So on Tuesday, House Democrats filed their impeachment brief, arguing that Trump had singular responsibility for the storming of the Capitol that occurred on January 6th. Then the Senate should convict him for incitement of insurrection against the republic he swore to protect. Well, you know that generally speaking. Here's some of the rhetoric in this article of impeachment. And they go back a little bit, just so you are prepared for trial. I want to make sure everybody's prepared for
Thank
trial.
Thank you. These briefings, we need this.
Yeah. We'll Thanks. Do a little voir dire later. In the months...
I had voir dire for dinner last night.
Good. Then you should be prepared to, we should be prepared to figure out whether or not you're a competent juror. So that's perfect. In the months preceding the joint session, President Trump repeatedly issued false statements asserting that the presidential election results were the product of widespread fraud and should not be accepted, by the American people or certified by state and federal officials. Then he addressed the crowd at the Ellipse in D.C., reiterating the false claims. We won this election and we won it by a landslide, quote unquote. And also, if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore, quote unquote. Those are the two lines that they used from his remarks on January 6th to say those were the lines that incited the riot, and he has singular responsibility for it. They also suggest he had made prior efforts to subvert and obstruct the certification of the results, and they cite the call with Brad Raffensperger, Georgia Secretary of State, where he asked Raffensperger to, quote-unquote, find enough votes to overturn the election results in Georgia, therefore betraying his trust as president to the manifest injury of the people of the United States. Remove this man! Okay. So the response is interesting. It doesn't get too much into any back and forth on election fraud other than to reject the notion that President Trump's claims were false because, as his attorneys write, there has been insufficient evidence exists upon which a reasonable jurist can conclude that the 45th president's statements were accurate or not, and he therefore denies they were false, which is a fair read. They basically say a couple of things. One, the whole trial is void ab initio, meaning invalid at the outset. They don't have jurisdiction.
Yeah, because you can't impeach a private citizen.
They also make mention that you have essentially a bill of attainder by the House, a legislative body acting to impose a penalty absent any sort of due process. House of Representatives deprived the 45th president of due process by rushing to issue the article, ignoring their own procedures and precedents going back to the mid-19th century. The lack of due process included, but was not limited to, its failure to conduct any meaningful committee review or other investigation, engage in any full and fair consideration of the evidence in support of the article, as well as the failure to conduct any full and fair discussion by allowing the 45th president's positions to be heard in the House chamber. None of that occurred. So those that also inconsistent with House precedent and notions of due process in a free society. These are important points to make out because they establish a principled foundation to suggest that the trial itself is illegitimate. You know, to borrow a phrase, the trial itself is fruit of the poisonous tree.
Do you think President Trump will testify in his own defense?
Well, the question is,
does anybody want to see that happen too?
Well, that's the question, I suppose, more than will he is, should he? This is always the question. Do I think he should?
312.
No.
Yeah, do you think he should?
But I'll take opposing views on that.
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Just a couple of things in their answer to the substance, to the extent there is any, of the charges. They responded to the, if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore. This was the statement that the Democrats are saying, and 10 Republicans, incited the riot.
Right.
They go on to say that it is denied that the phrase, if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore, had anything to do with the action at the Capitol, as it was clearly the need to fight for election security in general, as evidenced by the recording of the speech. It's denied President Trump intended to interfere with the counting of electoral votes. And they go on to sort of repeat the same things that we've repeated here. But I just you need to know what the answer is, because you need to know that the attorneys, his legal team, are taking a very matter-of-fact approach to the salacious charges. They're not sort of responding to the hype with hype, responding to the overstatement of the case with an overstatement of their case. It's very matter of fact. And even on the Raffensperger call, they argue in their answer, Trump was expressing his opinion that if the evidence was carefully examined, one would find that you have many that aren't even signed. You have many that are forgeries. He wasn't trying to have Raffensperger manufacture something that didn't exist, which is exactly the point that we made in talking through that call once the audio was released, the transcript was released, that if you put it in the context of him going through all of the evidence that his team pulled together, they were and what they wanted the Secretary of State to look at when his election attorneys interceded, who were on that call, it's pretty clear they were saying, well, we think, you know, these batches of votes are problematic. And if you could look at these batches of votes, we think you'd find the necessary evidence to we think there's the necessary evidence is there that would suggest that President Trump ultimately won the state. And if it's not there, one of his attorneys said, then so be it. So all we're asking is look at these areas that we've identified. We think there's evidence there. If it turns out that we're wrong, then we're wrong. And then that's the end of it. That is the subject of a part of the impeachment argument for House Democrats, which shows you just how out on a ledge they are with respect to the claims they're making about his ongoing threat to the security of the nation, which is, by the way, in there. Ongoing threat has demonstrated that he will remain a threat to national security, democracy, and the Constitution if allowed to remain in office. He's not in office.
No, he's not.
And has acted in a manner grossly incompatible with self-governance and the rule of law and so on and so forth.
Do you think that's why they took all his media platforms away? Because if he was still on Twitter and all that, he'd have more. He'd be sucking all the attention away from Biden in his first 100 days.
Who's paying attention to Biden? The press corps? The public?
No one's hardly paying attention to him anyway. I'm saying if Trump was on social media, on Twitter and on Facebook, people would be more interested in that. And same with the left media. They'd be doing that rather than focusing on Biden.
They're more interested in him even though he's not on those platforms.
Right. What was it, a shark sighting that looked like Trump?
They can't quit
Repeat
him.
Repeat that story. I can't quit you, Marion.
Rich in Franklin Park.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I just like to bring up a simple point. In Trump's speech, he touted how him and his administration took action to penalize people who damaged federal property, statues, etc. And not a single person has brought that up in that same speech. Thanks. Have a good day.
Thanks for the call, Frank.
I mean, I didn't feel a call to action when I heard him say those words. That, you know, if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore. You've said, you know, if we don't have, you know, verifiable or solid elections, we've lost our country.
Well, I mean,
that wasn't a call to arms, like to go storm the federal building or anything.
It's the whole insurrection. By the way, again, the incitement crowd, those who are arguing that President Trump's remark constitutes incitement. Well, boy, some of those federal cases really present a problem for your case. They would if it was a court of law, wouldn't it? When you have conspiracy charges against people who brought pipe bombs, you have conspiracy charges against people who had clearly planned to disrupt attack and create chaos. When you have law enforcement communicating, apparently to Capitol Police, offering help and Capitol Police rebuffing it. We still don't know, by the way, answers to questions that John Solomon raised that should be answered. With respect to what was anticipated on January 6th, what did federal law enforcement relay to Capitol Police, and what could Capitol Police relay to the sergeant at arms in the respective chambers, and what did those sergeants at arms relay to the respective heads of those chambers, McConnell and Pelosi?
Yeah, she's in charge of the sergeant at arms.
So, you know, you can't, there's no such thing as a planned incitement.
Well, and if I was one of Trump's defense attorneys, I would play this soundbite from AOC, because, you know, she's an Instagrammer, where she said that she knew 2 weeks before that there was going to be violence. So how is President Trump to blame for inciting violence?
A week before, 1 week before, the week prior to the insurrection, I started to get text messages that I needed to be careful, and that in particular, I needed to be careful about the 6th. And those text messages came from other members of Congress. They were not threats, but they were other members saying that they knew.
Well, so everybody knew. So how is this Trump's fault?
Yeah. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for taking the call. Listen, just like usual, these dumb rats always take and push everything way too far. And I'm going to tell you what, this is going to expose again. Trump's going to come out winner, look at like where it'll show that guy is basically innocent and all that and everything. And the dumb rats are going to take and shoot themselves in the foot and be shown for the kind of rotten, corrupt people they are in trying to basically get projection that they consistently use, and makes me sick. I want to puke with those people.
All right. Thanks for the call, Craig. Hopefully you won't
don't get sick.
Spew up your breakfast. Right.
Find a garbage can.
Keep it together. I just want to now, at least a minimum here. Now, everybody has been fully briefed on the case.
Uh-huh.
And you can talk about it intelligently
during
the Super Bowl party, since you're not allowed to watch the game or cheer.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Dan and Amy, take a quick call. Ed and Glen Allen, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, I think one of the bigger things is the whole public opinion. I mean, when I talk to people, they say, well, the whole Russia thing. Well, Russia was proved to be wrong. The problem is if this whole insurrection stuff is proved to be what it is, it's just a big sham. Bigger thing is getting everybody else to buy into the fact that that it wasn't anything that Trump did. And I think the media plays a huge role in swaying people's opinions and helping people understand what's actually going on here.
No question. Thanks for the call, Ed. Tell them to listen to our show, or just take what you hear from our show and tell them to listen to you. I mean, that's, you know, all people can do.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2 on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and St. Fauci, the patron saint of COVID-19, had a little confab that the Amazon Post carried live yesterday. He was asked by one of their fungible reporters about two masks, and he said, my colleagues and I were just discussing this yesterday, talking about the CDC is looking at doing a study of seeing whether or not two masks are better than one, like two hearts are better than one, Amy.
Two hearts that beat as one.
it makes common sense, you would think.
Yeah.
Perhaps it doesn't make common sense. I don't know what's happening. My world is being turned upside down, but Michael Osterholm, who's an epidemiologist from the University of Minnesota, a favorite of the D.C. press corps, he says of the two masks that they could actually do more harm than good if one of the face coverings isn't being worn correctly. So he's sort of tied to the middle of the issue. Tony Fauci's keeping his options open. I think, frankly, per the Ioannidis protocol, banishing somebody who used to be considered one of the top epidemiologists in the world because he doesn't share the established opinion of Tony Fauci. Now Michael Osterholm has to be shut down, like John Ioannidis has been, from the D.C. press corps, not recognized as an expert anymore because he's sort of freelancing here and not really staying in formation with Fauci. And we're talking about science or common sense or something. Interesting. So there's all kinds of questions about masks. I know we were going to wear them forever. That's for sure. That's the good news. But I just want to make sure we have the right number of masks. We're starting young enough. Maybe in vitro. I don't know.
I told you I was applying to meat market and somebody had a 9-month-old with a mask on. A 9-month-old. That is a choking hazard. The kids should have pacifiers in their mouths, not masks on their face.
Well, I don't know. I mean,
it's child abuse.
I'd hate for that couple to have to be re-educated, or that mom to be re-educated by some air waitress following whatever the airlines say based on whatever Tony Fauci says that day. But there was this study in Germany about the impacts of mask wearing on kids. And by the end of last year, this registry that these German researchers created had been used by about 20,000 people who entered data on a total of almost 26,000 children. The average wearing time for masks for these kids was 270 minutes a day, so, like 4.5 hours.
Good Lord.
Impairments caused by wearing the mask were reported by 68% of parents. They included irritability, 60% reporting, headache, 53% reporting, difficulty concentrating, 50% reporting, less happiness, 49% reporting, reluctance to go to school/kindergarten, 44% reporting, malaise, 42% reporting, impaired learning, 38% reporting, and drowsiness or fatigue, 37% reporting. And, of course, you know what I say to all that. Well, it's better to not learn or feel malaise than it is to die. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Dr. Eric Napudi. He's the owner of Napudi Wellness Centers in St. Louis, founder of Wellness Warrior as well. Dr. Napudi, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, good morning this morning. How are you today?
Good morning. So what's your perspective on mask wearing? I guess start in vitro and let's go up in age from there.
Well, I tell you what, the thing with in vitro wearing is a very interesting topic to me. And I think at some point we're probably going to get there with as crazy as the world is. You know, one of the things that I always talk about is common sense and how we say common sense isn't that common anymore. And we don't have common sense. We have COVID sense. And I think many of us, many of us remember back in, early when COVID started in the spring of last year or when it really started getting rampant. When Tony Fauci, the Surgeon General, everybody said, hey, don't wear a mask. Wearing a mask during a pandemic literally gives you a false sense of protection and just don't wear it. Well, and then we remember 2 weeks later whenever they all changed their tune. And according to the World Health Organization, when they were interviewed by the BBC, they said, this is Dr. Cohen who said this, the reason why they changed their tune wasn't based off of empirical scientific data. It was based off of political persuasion. And then remember when Tony Fauci came back and said, well, you know, I did tell a lie, but it was a noble lie.
Yes.
And so bottom line is, you
obviously,
lie.
Well, when we're talking about Fauci, we assume nobility. That is assumed.
Well, you know what assuming does. But I'll tell you this, is as a practicing physician and as a doctor that literally trains hundreds and thousands of doctors every year, one of the things that we're seeing in a rise, and I've been in practice 20 years, and I've never seen as much bacterial respiratory infections as I have now, especially in young children. And again, you know, even Dr. Fauci said the number one cause of death during the Spanish flu of 1918 was respiratory bacterial infections. And we're finding that to be the case now. And just again, that study that came out of Germany is such a damning study because, you know, 26,000 kids were looked at, and you read off the impairments perfectly. And in a world that we live in right now where, you know, kids already don't want to go to school, ADD, ADHD, and concentration are already on the rise. Now wearing a mask puts more impairments on these children and really puts our kids back decades.
Well,
and
doctor,
sorry, please.
No, go on. I was just going to say that the whole thing about bacterial pneumonia from wearing dirty masks. There's something to that. And I had Eric Zorn, he works for the Chicago Tribune, take me to task. Like, that's fake news and that's not possible. That's what happened to me. They gave me a lung x-ray. I don't have COVID, but I had bacterial pneumonia. And what we were doing was throwing our masks in a bowl when we got home.
Yeah.
And then reusing them and then maybe once a week washing them. They're like, no, you just use disposables every day. But that's going to clog up the landfills. And eventually all those masks are going to end up in the ocean. So forget the straws. We're going to have to worry about masks.
Well, you're 100% right. And then, you know, one of the most, quite honestly, and no offense, but idiotic comments that I hear from individuals out there, you know, when we're trained to do surgery, you know, you hear people say, well, if you don't think masks work, then tell your doctor not to wear one the next time he or
right.
she does procedure. Well, here's the common sense thing about that. What people don't think of is the fact that a mask worn in an operating room is used to keep my spit out of an open wound. You have to understand the human mouth has more bacteria in it than any other mammal on the planet. It's more filthy than the mouth of a pig, and that's a fact. And if I spit into an open wound where there's no immune system, that's going to cause an infection. So viruses have never been stopped by wearing masks in operating rooms. The only randomized controlled study that was done on this showed that clearly it does not do that, and that this is really more political motivated than anything. And quite honestly, I've spoken to five or six governors over the last 8 months. I've traveled all over the country educating, you know, congressmen and senators and all these other interesting individuals. And people are making decisions based off of political ideals and not off of scientific ideals. And it's quite a shame. We just did a video the other day, a group of doctors and I that work together. We showed 103 journal articles and peer review articles that shows that wearing a mask does not stop the spread of a virus. Now, if an individual chooses to do so, guess what? This is still America, and they should have the free will to do that, but they should know their risks versus their benefits. And the reality is it does not scientifically prove to stop the spread of viruses, period.
So what I hear you saying is two masks, three masks,
10 masks,
four.
Right.
What's the magic number? Yeah.
The study out of Virginia Tech, when they said, well, maybe we should wear two masks, a mask and then a cloth mask over that, gives us 75% protection, and wearing three of them gives us 90% protection against what? Yes, you put a pillow over your face enough and smother it, you're going to not be able to get a virus, but you're going to die because you can't breathe. Listen, the reality is this. We know this for a fact. If you have too much of a barrier between your mouth and the world, or your nose and the world, that that's going to increase carbon dioxide more than anything. And that is a very scary proposition in the body, considering when carbon dioxide goes up, our body becomes more acidic. When we're acidic, we're more susceptible to sickness and disease. So we have some serious problems going on, and the mask is one of them. But the reality is this, is we've been so scared and feared into wearing this thing that I'm just telling you, people are scared to death to take their mask off.
Could you advise us on at what decibel level we should maintain our cheering during the Super Bowl this weekend? The CDC is a little unclear.
And if you wear
this.
A mask, can you cheer?
Well, if you listen to Fauci and God bless old Deborah Birx and even the good old politicians in your area, you're supposed to just snap your fingers and not be excited about anything. God forbid people get vocal and talk and spread a virus. And in fact, if you look now, there was a study that was just published out that shows that there's more anal oral spread of fecal matter to the mouth to spread COVID than there is droplets to droplets. So
I don't know who those people are hanging out with, but those are not my friends.
Right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Well, so we got an answer for that. We got the Chinese anal swabs that are going to be popularized at the airports.
Yeah. Well, soon coming to a neighborhood near you, as well as the drive-through anal swabs. That ought to be a pretty good
Can you pull a little closer to the window, sir? Yes. I want to ask, people that are wearing masks outside, wasn't the purpose of wearing a mask outside is if you can't be 6 feet apart from somebody? Because there's so many lobotomized people that, you know, one thing I realize, there's a lot of lemmings out there that we're never going to reach. But isn't that the purpose to wear a mask if you're – the bottom line, why wear a mask outside?
There is no reason to do so. I literally had – on one of my radio shows, we did a debate against a PhD Nobel Prize-winning scientist who put out there that, you know, we should definitely wear masks 24/7, 365, no matter what. And one of the topics we discussed was – wearing a mask outside, and he even admitted there's absolutely no data, no science, no point whatsoever of wearing a mask outside. So again, people are just doing things to do things, kind of like when you go to the grocery store and you see the plexiglass between you and the cashier. That's not doing anything. That's false evidence. That's doing something to think that we're doing something. And I agree with the fact that one thing that Tony Fauci did said at the beginning that is true is wearing a mask gives someone false protection of something because they're always fiddling with their face. They're not wearing the mask, right? It's causing more harm than good. So, ladies and gentlemen, we need to realize that it is our decision. It's our bodies. It's our right. It's our decision to do what we want to do. And these mask-wearing situations, it's just gone way, way out of hand.
Maybe like with the taking the vaccine and you have like politicians or old people that take the vaccine in a very public way as to provide examples to others and stuff. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could do the same thing with the anal swabs. I'd like to see Tony Fauci be anal swabbed on television so that I feel more comfortable when I take my next flight to Southwest Florida. Sure, go ahead. If Fauci can do it, then please swab away. What do you think?
We're laughing about this, but you wait and see until that shows up on a television commercial.
Yeah.
I mean, I swear that there's a group of people at some point, I don't know if it's the CDC, I don't know if it's a marketing company, but I think there's a group of about 20 guys, and they're smoking some of the best legalized marijuana out there, and they're saying, hey, let's see if they'll do this. And then whenever they go, oh my gosh, I can't believe they did that, now tell them to do this. That's what's happening right now.
You think anal swab is going to come here? That's going to happen?
Let me
tell you this. God bless you both. You can go to the front of the line to get that done. Mm-hmm. But what I'll tell you is this. Did you ever think that we'd have a mandate for a mask? Did you ever think that we'd have restaurants and businesses shut down for over a year, did you ever think that we'd have a potential forced vaccine program in our country? I mean, again, I'm all about freedom to choose, but, you know, the things that have happened over the last 14 months, we could have, I mean, who would have ever predicted this? So who knows what's going to come out next?
And we still don't have school. Yeah.
Dr. Eric Napudi, owner of Napudi Wellness Centers in St. Louis, founder of Wellness Warrior as well. Doc, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Have a blessed day, everybody.
You too. Thank you so much. And he joined us on our turnkey Pro answer line.
It's like a hot steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, we're talking about mask wearing starting in utero and being anally swabbed before you're allowed to enter the grocery store, just out of an abundance of caution. Andy in Hinsdale.
So at the risk of turning Dan even more disgusted with the general public's behavior, I was in Jackson Hole, Wyoming last week on a snowboarding trip and walking down the street through Jackson, the downtown area, in the middle of the Teton National Forest, probably the cleanest, most pristine air in the country and the most overeducated crowd you could probably find in the U.S. Everybody's got a mask on.
Really?
And the stores are handing out stickers saying, "I wore a mask, Jackson Hole 2020.
Well, you know it's a tourist trap then, right? Because I can't imagine Wyoming residents are that way.
They're all Californians.
Yeah, exactly. And one guy from Hinsdale. Thanks for the call, Andy. Appreciate it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We've entered a new era of political truthiness once Jen Psaki has time to get to just exactly the response right to convey to the public.
I'll circle back if there's more I can share with you. I'll circle back with you if there's more to convey. I'll have to just circle back with you. We can circle back. I'm happy to circle back with you. I can circle back. I will have to circle back on that one. That's an excellent question. Oh, such an important question. We will circle back with you, and we'll circle back with you. It's an interesting question, but we'll circle back. I'm happy to circle back, but I'll have to circle back with you on it. It's a good question, but we'll circle back with you on this today. We will certainly circle back with you more directly.
Hopefully we're going to hear less of that now that she's asked for the questions in advance from the press corps. So that should clear up the surprising questions that she gets she's not prepared to answer.
Unbelievable. I called that, though, because during the campaign, they you know, previewed questions and screened questions for Biden. Now they're doing it for her. That's her job. She's supposed to be able to handle any question that comes her way.
Maybe Donna Brazile can get the questions and slip them to Jen Psaki before her briefings. For more on the change in attitude in the D.C. press corps, as well as this provocative notion that conservative millennials have gone the way of the dodo bird, pleased to be joined by David Keltz. He's was a speechwriter in the executive branch. He's the author of Media Bias in the Trump Presidency and the Extinction of the Conservative Millennial. And he had served as an intern in the White House for VP Pence as well. David, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So, like everybody else that has a room temperature IQ, you've noticed a bit of a change in the tenor of the D.C. press corps with the changeover in administrations.
Yes, certainly. It's almost as if the previous reporters that were in the White House covering the Trump administration have now been replaced by White House interns that are just very excited about the opportunity to even be in the briefing room.
Yeah, what happened to Jim Acosta? He left once President Trump was gone. Where did he go?
Right. Well, I imagine he's probably working on a book deal or something. But I just want to point out that, you know, when Kelly McEnany started as Trump's press secretary, Jonathan Carl, the White House correspondent for ABC, started by asking her if she promised to be truthful and transparent, and she said that she would be. And, of course, Jen Psaki has promised the same thing. But I don't remember the press corps back then when McEnany said that she was going to be truthful. I don't remember them giving her the benefit of any doubt or saying, isn't this a wonderful thing that she's going to do for us?
What should the GOP response to this be? I mean, I hate just sort of complaining about things that we know are true without really doing much about it or directing people other places to go. I mean, nobody's really watching these press briefings anymore either. Anyway, nobody really is paying attention to Joe Biden for good or bad. They're just not. We're more interested on the center right side in arguing about what's going to happen to Liz Cheney or Marjorie Taylor Greene within the House Republican caucus.
Yes. Well, I guess apparently I'm maybe the only person on the right who's had the unfortunate opportunity to watch or listen to all of these press briefings in some form. I really believe that there needs to be more reporters along the lines of Peter Ducey who are actually going to ask insightful questions about these now more than 40 executive actions or 40 executive orders that President Biden has taken. And there really needs to be somebody to ask for what specifically is in these policies and how exactly they're going to help the everyday American person. And I'm not hearing much of that. I know that House Majority Leader McCarthy gave a speech yesterday. The Republican Majority Leader talked about how we need to learn more about energy policy and how that can benefit the American worker. But I'm not hearing much at this point from the Republican Party about what we're going to do to combat this. And certainly the meeting with the 10 Republicans at the White House, you had Senator Romney was there and Susan Collins and wonderful. How they're trying to, you know, this $1.9 trillion stimulus that President Biden has offered is going to be a disaster. J.P. Morgan came out with an estimate that said that most states have actually not seen a decrease in their revenue. So there's no reason to send $350 billion to bail out poorly run Democrat states.
With respect to the extinction of the conservative millennial, expound on that. Where the conservative millennials, so we're talking about kids that are just out of college to just under 40 years old. There's no conservatives to be found in that demographic?
Well, perhaps the word extinction is a little bit too severe, but I think it's certainly true that in my experience, being a millennial and someone that was on college campuses in the last decade or so, there's very few conservatives to be found that either will admit they're conservative or will speak openly about this. And I do believe that it's now, as these graduates come into the workforce and we're seeing more and more of the woke culture and the business, the corporate social justice and what have you, that they're trying to basically say that you can't have a voice if you have a difference of opinion. And my fear is that people who have real skills they're not going to be hired based off merit or based off their ability to actually do the job, but more so as to whether or not they have the same political views. And I think that's a huge problem, especially when you look at the lack of employment opportunities right now.
And so your diagnosis, though, in terms of a real dynamic on the landscape. But how did this come to be, do you think? Particularly with millennials.
I think there's a number of factors. Firstly, a lot of, even millennials who grew up in a conservative household, by the time they finish high school or get to a college campus, in many ways it's sort of, a growing of age thing where it's common to have different views and almost rebel against your parents' views. But I think the indoctrination of what has happened on college campuses with professors who refuse to hear any other point of view has made it so that a lot of students now, they don't want to write an essay or even ask a question that could potentially get them a bad grade in a class. And so I think that has kind of boiled over now.
Well, that's happening at the high school level. I know a Lane Tech student who leans pretty Republican and was questioning his social studies teacher, and she put him on mute and is not allowing him to speak because she does not like his views because it doesn't go along with her narrative.
Right.
So it's just not happening at the college level. It's happening at high schools too.
we've gone at rapid speed from I'll defend to the death your position. You know, but I disagree, but I'll defend your right to speak. Now you don't have the opportunity to speak. And I think that is a serious problem that we're seeing all across the country now. And with the isolation and more virtual learning, I think that you're going to find it's even less likely that students are going to want to speak out at any level.
Do you worry at all, particularly for young people, that this polarization and the silencing of dissent will push people towards more extreme, not just positions, maybe even less so positions, but more extreme actions in defense of support of their positions?
Well, I'm sure that could go for either side, but I definitely think that when you're, you know, Tucker Carlson has been speaking about this a lot lately. I mean, a lot of these executive actions that we keep hearing about involve racial equity, and no one really from the Biden team seems to be able to articulate what exactly that means. I'm probably the only person who actually looked through one of the executive orders that mentioned it, and there's not a whole lot of substance there, but I think that you are going to see a backlash when you're, you know, a certain skin color, and you're basically being told that your skin color you don't matter because of your skin color, and we want to help other people. And I just think that that's going to cause a lot of division.
Since you are one, as you say, who do those who lean center right in that millennial demographic? I mean, who do you get the sense they look to for intellectual guidance or guidance generally?
Certainly, Ben Shapiro is a major player, as you know. He's got a podcast. He's got the Daily Wire. People like Charlie Kirk probably are pretty popular. And so I think a lot of millennials tend to look to people that are on the younger cohort. They're not necessarily watching Fox News, but they're definitely listening to podcasts, and they're trying to have an understanding of how did this happen exactly? Why are we told in school that our country is just terrible and miserable? Why can't we have another way of looking at things? And I think that they are. That's why these platforms are becoming incredibly successful.
You think that I don't know what sort of perspective you have on this or could have on this, but they listen to this person or that person. They get the sense that they read anything, that they have any understanding of American history or historical movements in the West, any notion of this concept of the Western canons, any appreciation for the language or arts. Do they think at all, or do they just surf YouTube? I mean, obviously we're making wild overgeneralizations, but so, you know, generally speaking, that's what we're talking about, generally speaking. That they don't know anything, so they're just repeating lines that they heard from other people who are also repeating lines that they heard from other people, and they have no foundation for what they're repeating. They have no real understanding. They're just repeating lines because a lot of the people they listen to also have never read a book of any particular import, even though they may have written some books, and they are just repeating lines too.
Well, that goes to the point of this being a problem on both the left or right. You know, it's not limited to one persuasion. And I think that, you know, it's definitely true that a lot of people these days are especially younger people are spending a lot of time on social media. And you ask if they read, well, maybe they're reading 280 characters, but I don't know personally how many books they're reading. And I think that when you look at simply just retweeting a phrase that kind of sounds catchy or is a quick win, that's wonderful, but if you want to actually have a conversation with somebody and be able to articulate your ideas about why liberty and the Constitution and property rights and that kind of the conservative principles that we espouse, I think you'd be hard pressed to find a lot of young people that can articulate why that's the view that they have.
Yeah, and there are no books, by the way, guys, because it could have coronavirus on it, so everything's online.
Yeah, I think it
doesn't include books.
Yeah, right, okay. I think you're getting to something, actually. I think that's exactly right. They look at this like YouTube. Conservatism has just become like another like WWF fake sport. Slammed this guy in an interview or something like that, and then you actually watch the thing, and it's nothing of the sort, number one. It's just hype. And number two, it's not even particularly interesting. It's just a repetition of pat lines that you could cut and paste from the RNC website, for example, on our side to be a little bit self-reflective. I think that's a huge problem, and I don't think very many people talk about it. This latest person on TV's book or this latest pundit's book, and we talk to some of those people, not too many because they're boring, because they don't know anything. So I don't know. I mean, it's somebody who actually probably speaks to them and has more cachet with that generation, including center-right sort of activists of that generation than certainly I do. You know, maybe that maybe explore that some more and you could repopulate the species of conservative millennials.
Yeah, well, certainly I'm trying to write articles that I think give a different perspective, a point of view, and they lend a voice to the conservative side. And so, you know, an article is typically anywhere from 800 to 850 words. So that would be a good start, would just be for young conservatives to check out. I'd certainly recommend the American Spectator, where I've written a number of articles for. And I just think that there needs to be more of people having the courage to do research on their own and not because they're assigned something in class. I mean, reading is not supposed to be something that is strenuous and difficult. You know, perhaps people feel that way, but maybe they just haven't been picked up the right material.
David Keltz, speechwriter, former speechwriter in the executive branch, author of Media Bias in the Trump Presidency and the Extinction of the Conservative Millennial. He also served as a White House intern for VP Pence. David, thanks for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, this gentleman was an Illinois state senator for 20 years. He served as the assistant majority leader in the Illinois Senate.
Yeah.
He was the 27th ward alderman in the city of Chicago. He was the secretary and treasurer of the Cook County Forest Preserve.
Oh, I love the Forest Preserve.
His name is?
Is?
Ricky Hollywood Hendon.
Oh.
And he's got a new video out.
I need my money. I roll the money. Y'all know the hustle. I need my money. I roll the money.
Money. Kind of catchy.
I need my money.
Is this a joke?
I roll the money. I need my check. My 10K. My 10K. My 10K. My 10K. Came out, I wanted to shout.
Yeah, the Ricky Hollywood Hendon singers in the background. And he's like on a skiff of some sort of trying to front as a big, like, you know, as a rap guy with bling and chicks and the whole thing.
This isn't a joke?
Not a joke.
This is real?
Not a joke. Real.
What's gosh, Ricky Hollywood Hendon. Well, we created the beast. I mean, we always called him Ricky Hollywood Hendon, so of course he'd end up making a music video.
Yeah.
Is he putting the ATM card in the machine and then no money comes out and he just wants to shout?
I need my Rona money.
Oh.
My free money. I need my Obama phone. Chicago, Illinois. State Senator, 20 years. Assistant Majority Leader, Illinois State Senate. Chicago City Alderman, Secretary Treasurer of Cook County Forest Preserve, Chicago and Illinois. Any questions?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy and Democrats, socialists on the Hill moving forward with their $2 trillion funny money plan and for quote-unquote COVID relief. Chuck Schumer, again, saying earlier in this week, one of the most profound statements you'll hear in terms of the honest expression of the Democrat socialists philosophy.
It makes no sense to pinch pennies when so many Americans are struggling. The risk of doing too little is far greater than the risk of doing too much.
That ranks right up there with Joe Biden famously saying during the bailouts of the Obama era, we have to continue spending money to keep from going bankrupt. It turns out that actually there are risks to doing too much with the or pinching pennies, as Schumer, or not pinching, I should say, not pinching pennies, as Schumer said. Give you a sense of where we're at. Phil Graham, former Senator Phil Graham, has a good write-up in the Wall Street Journal. Commerce Department data. Total employee compensation in the second and third quarters of 2020 was down by $215 billion. Employee compensation down by $215 billion. Yet government personnel transfers were up $893 billion. So 4.5x the decline in compensation. In the second quarter alone, real per capita disposable income was up 10.5% compared with the first quarter, 25 times as fast as the average quarterly income growth in the prior 2 years. A historical savings rate of 7 to 8% income reached an astonishing 26% in the second quarter. Preliminary data for 2020 show total savings for 2020 was $1.6 trillion higher than in 2019, and that was before the last round, the last $900 billion worth of relief before Trump exited stage right. So it predates what is the $2 trillion on the table. So we don't have a people getting by problem. Yes, I understand some people, yes. But this is not surgical. This is airdropping funny money off the printing press. And there are economic implications to continuing to do so willy-nilly in spite of data like Phil Graham has provided. For more on those implications, we're pleased to be joined by Steve Moore, economist, Wall Street Journal columnist, Trumponomics author. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, guys. By the way, it also reminds me of when George Bush said, you know, we have to destroy capitalism to save it.
Yeah.
You can't make this stuff up. But this is, you know, I don't know if we should be laughing or you know, crying or running for the high grass right now. The Democrats are acting like fiscal lunatics. This is crazy. You know, they proposed $1.9 trillion in spending. And as we note in our daily hotline this morning, did you know, Dan, Amy, they have $1 trillion from the past 5 stimulus bills they still haven't even spent. It's unbelievable. There's $1 trillion. That's $1 million they haven't even spent, and they insist we need another $1.9 trillion.
But why haven't they spent it, though? There's so many small businesses that need help. Why haven't they spent the money? Why is it sitting there?
Well, it's government. I mean, it's government. They're incompetent. It just sits in these accounts. And it goes back to 2009. Remember when Obama said it's going to be shovel ready projects? And, you know, for 3 years, the money just got gobbled up by the system. And the unemployment rate kept going up and up and up. More government spending is not going to save us. It isn't. And you're so right, Amy. You've got a lot of small businesses and restaurants and shops and stores that are really suffering right now. But obviously, the solution now is to get this, get these stores opened, and I don't know what the status of things is in Chicago. But I think I told you guys last week I was in Florida. Everything's normal in Florida. The stores are open, the beaches are open, the restaurants are open. You can't even get a reservation at a restaurant. It's, you know, and it's just night and day in America today. But the most important thing is get the vaccine out there. But $1.9 trillion, by the way, most of the spending in this bill, Dan and Amy, has nothing to do with coronavirus. It's just the Bernie Sanders agenda, $15 on a minimum wage, bail out the mass transit systems, give schools $150 billion. By the way, Dan and Amy, please explain to me why schools that have been shut down for the last 10 months need more money. I mean, it's the most absurd thing I've ever heard.
I know they're supposed to use $25 million, you know, in Chicago and CPS, you know, for PPE and for this HIPAA or air filtration system. And they ended up spending $100 million, and they're still not open.
And are the teachers still on strike? Or?
Well, we're at a cooling off period, Mr. Moore. I don't know if you know, a 2-day cooling off.
A cooling off period.
And Mayor Lightfoot yesterday blamed Trump. the Trump administration for the impasse between the CPS and CTU because he didn't offer enough vaccines to the teachers.
So is the underlying question is, in this quote cooling off period, are
they're
the
still
kids
e-learning.
In school?
No, no kids are in school. No.
They're on strike. I mean, it's ridiculous. Most of the, you know, by the way, my kids have been going to, Catholic schools for the last year. They haven't virtually missed a day of school. Do you think anybody's gotten sick? Do you think anybody's died? Do you think any teachers have died? I mean, we have experiments out there. I mean, we've got private schools that are open every day, ladies and gentlemen, and the teachers aren't getting sick. The kids aren't getting sick. But you know what? The kids are learning. And that's why so many people are shifting their kids out of public schools into private schools. But not one penny of that $1.9 trillion, Dan, write this down, not one penny of that money shall go to a private school because we cannot allow that. We can't allow the money to go to schools that are functioning. We have to give the money to schools that are not functioning.
That's right. And by the way, on this show, we don't use the S word, strike. Don't use that again. The only S word that the only S word that the teachers union is talking about is safety. That's the only S word.
Okay.
It's all,
well,
it's all safety.
I can say, and you and I are old enough to remember what the Gipper did in 1981 when he came in and he fired the illegally striking. I'm going to use the S word. I know it's not allowed on this show or in the city of Chicago. The illegal striking of air traffic controllers, and it changed everything. And
well,
all of a sudden, we had to.
Yeah, the Gipper is not the mayor of Chicago.
Yeah.
I know that's the problem, isn't it?
Well, something else here. You know, Republicans with Trump gone have now gotten back to their, halving or quartering whatever craziness the Democrats propose and calling themselves conservatives. And so that's what 10 senators did with respect to this latest relief plan. And they don't make arguments. They just let the sentimental nonsense from the left go on challenge. Janet Yellen saying, the Secretary of Treasury saying that the $1.9 trillion is needed to, quote, help families at risk of going hungry or losing the roof over their heads, unquote. Last year, the average household in the bottom quintile of earners received more than $45,000 of government transfer payments from any combination of more than 100 programs and credits. And
where do those numbers come from, Dan?
Phil Graham, Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Yeah, that's unbelievable.
22.6 million households received food stamps. And that doesn't even count the rent forbearance going on in New York City L.A. and California and Illinois and Chicago. I mean, where is the response to say from anybody on the Hill that wears an R to say this is all unnecessary? Why can't somebody make the argument that Phil Graham is making in The Wall Street Journal?
Good question. I mean, look, Republican, I believe that Republican, every single Republican, my job for the next, month or so until they pass this horrid bill is to make sure that every single Republican in Congress votes against it. Remember what happened? Look, folks, this is a replay of what happened in Obama's first year. And the left is rewriting the history of this. I lived through it. I was the chief economics writer at the Wall Street Journal at the time. We must have written 50 editorials trashing that stupid, what did they call it? Shovel-ready projects bill. And what happened was, They spent $850 billion. And guess what happened in the next 2 years? The unemployment rate was still 8-9%. I mean, the recession did not end. It was a complete failure. And here's the interesting thing about this story, because it's relevant to what's happening today. Back in around 2011 or 12, I had this famous debate with Paul Krugman. Paul Krugman was the biggest fan of shovel-ready projects. We got to spend. And I showed him the evidence that this was, we actually had fewer jobs after this stimulus bill than we would have had if we had done nothing, according to the Obama administration's own numbers. So it was a complete flop, ladies and gentlemen, a complete flop. And that was very embarrassing to Paul Krugman. And I'll never forget what he said back then, because it's now become the Democratic line. He said, Steve, the reason it didn't work, Dan, why didn't it work?
Why didn't the shovel-ready projects work?
Yeah. What do you think the left said why it didn't work?
Oh, not big enough.
Yeah, not big enough. And we laughed them out of the room at that time. I mean, we laughed them out. It was such an absurd. Oh, gee, if we had spent $2 trillion rather than $1 trillion, everything would have been just fine. But why is that relevant today? Listen to what Joe Biden, listen to what Chuck Schumer, you just played the piece by, Chuck Schumer. Let's not pinch pennies this time. And even Janet Yellen said it. She said, the lesson we learned from 2009 is we didn't
spend and borrow enough money. Folks, these people are crazy. Their heads are spinning around. They're lunatics. There's no limit. By the way, if this $2 trillion bill doesn't work, are they going to spend and borrow $4 trillion?
Well, what's going to happen to states like South Dakota? I mean, they don't need the federal money right now. Because last time she didn't touch it, she said, no, you know, thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah. Well, this is the big story in America that it's hard to probably, you know, hear when you're there in Chicago in the middle of blue state America. But half of the country is up and running, folks.
Yep.
Half of the recession is in Illinois. It's in New York. It's in New Jersey. It's in California. It's in Connecticut. It's in Rhode Island. It's in Michigan. Gee, what do all those states have in common? They have Democratic mayors and governors who shut down their economies. So why should people in South Dakota and Tennessee and Texas and Georgia and Florida, where things are back to normal, have to bail out the cities and the states that are run by Democrats? I mean, somebody explain the fairness of that to me. Because there's $300 billion in this bill to bail out Illinois, New York, and California.
Steve Moore, economist, Wall Street Journal columnist, author of Trumponomics. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Okay, guys. Sorry, I'm angry today. You can tell.
Okay.
It's just out.
We love you. Bye. All right, good seeing you too, or talking to you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and St. Valentine's Day is just around the corner.
Oh, yeah. What are you going to get me?
I wish we could all get, could all have the love that Dougie and Kamala enjoy. The Huffington Post was kind enough to put together a compilation of 11 Kamala Harris and Doug Emhoff marriage quotes that capture their love.
Oh, please. Really? Do we need music behind this, too?
The moment I met Kamala, I knew I was in love, not just because of who she is, the warm, funny, compassionate woman who grounds our family, but also because of the deep resolve with which she fights for the causes she believes in.
Oh, that's so romantic.
Yeah, excuse
Ew,
me. Sorry.
Stop it.
Sorry.
Stop. I'm not listening, honestly.
Hold on. I'll try and get through it.
Okay.
My stomach is upset all of a sudden.
Well, I know, but I don't need to hear it.
On watching her work, Dougie, imagine working from home with Kamala Harris during a pandemic and all the other issues going on. She just works hard and she's relentless. It's just incredible how much she does. And I'm looking over her and she's looking back and she goes, "What are you doing, Dougie? You working?" And I say, "Yep. Yes, honey." Oh, I can't.
I like, you know what, this makes me miss Bill and Hillary Clinton's love story in the library.
Mm.
I tried to touch her in the back of the head, but I resisted.
Now, they're a modern family, don't you know? And so Kamala, on her relationship with Dougie's ex-wife.
Oh, how is that?
To know Cole and Ella is to know their mother, Kirsten, is an incredible mother. Kirsten and I hit it off ourselves and our dear friend. She and I became a duo of cheerleaders in the bleachers at Ella's swim meets and basketball games, often to Ella's embarrassment. You guys, we sometimes joke that our modern family is almost a little too functional.
Sometimes it's hard being so perfect.
Yeah. They met on a blind date.
Right, don't you know?
Her friend said, "Just trust me." You know, she wanted me to just kind of go into it. And she said, "Don't Google him." But I did.
I Google. What'd she find?
Silly heart. Infectious. Tom and Tom Sudeikis in Barrington, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, Tom.
Oh, good morning, guys. Well, that's what happens when Doug swipes right. I just threw up all over myself, and I got to go home and change. So thanks a lot. Have a great day.
Sorry about that, Tom. I warned you.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Three kinds of lies. Lies, damn lies, and statistics. That was actually Benjamin Disraeli, I believe, who said that. It's often attributed to Mark Twain, which reminds me of Ambrose Bierce's definition of a quotation, which is the act of repeating erroneously the words of another. I like it. That's why this book caught my eye, this new book out, Data Detective, 10 Easy Rules to Make Sense of Statistics, and obviously because science and data is the word that is repeated like a magical incantation by policymakers and public health professionals in the context of COVID, but also just everything. Everything in life is data-driven. Everything in business is data-driven. We need to be data-centric and so forth. Data.
You sound so smart if you know the science and the data.
Statistics. And so, of course, we have a problem in that most people are not particularly conversant in statistics, at least ones that have sort of the foundational grounding that makes them relevant, the context. And there are all sorts of fallacies that abound in when people discuss data and stats to inform their understanding of a particular challenge or a particular topic or a particular policy proposal. So to help us get better with stats, we're pleased to be joined by the author of the aforesaid book, Tim Harford. He's an award-winning columnist, broadcaster, and economist, best-selling author of The Undercover Economist and, as I mentioned, The Data Detective, 10 Easy Rules to Make Sense of Statistics, which was released just yesterday. Tim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
All right. So give us some easy rules that people can apply to being better or demanding that their friends and family members get better when discussing stats to try to make an argument or support a particular policy.
Oh, Dan, let's not get onto the question of how we can get our friends and family members to be smarter about statistics. I just want to fix myself. I'm not going to help you fix anybody else.
All right.
So, I mean, the rule that I think people find most surprising has nothing to do with calculators or spreadsheets. I just encourage people to notice their own emotional reaction to a claim, because so often statistics aren't used to show us the world. They're used to try to win an argument. And I think if you see a claim on social media, you hear something on the radio, and you immediately think, oh, that can't be true, that's fake news, or you think, oh, this just proves I was right all along, whatever that emotional reaction is, it's immediately making you stupider. And if we could just take 2 seconds to notice that knee-jerk reaction, we would immediately, I think, start to think more clearly about what's actually being put in front of us, the evidence.
So take the emotions out of it, which is difficult for some people.
Yeah. Well, it's difficult for us all. We're all human. And of course, it's fine to feel emotions. I mean, if something outrageous is happening, it's okay to be outraged. But I think we need to at least notice that, because if we're just hitting retweet or like or share on Facebook or Twitter, we're immediately responding to a claim, we're not our best selves. Right? We're not thinking as clearly as we could do. So just notice that.
Oh, one of the other things that you point to is publication bias. And I want to amplify that a bit, because this in part explains why people have distorted senses of the particular presence of something in society. For example, there was a survey a few months ago. What do you think the case fatality rate, the infection fatality rate for COVID is? And the median response came back to be about 10% of the population, when in point of fact, you know, at that time, I think it was still under, I think the case fatality rate was something like 0.5% or something like that. So to be off by a factor of 20x is a problem, and it speaks to how you're receiving information and the assumptions you're making about the information you're receiving.
You're absolutely right. So there's everything that we see on social media, on the media, even in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, if that's the kind of thing you like to read, it's been through a particular filter. And a lot of that filter is about what's interesting, what's surprising. So we're more likely to see a report of, say, a 25-year-old dying of COVID than we are of an 85-year-old dying of COVID, even though when you look at the statistics, 85-year-olds are way, 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 like 1,000 times, 2,000, 3,000 times more vulnerable than the young. Because it's a surprise that a 25-year-old died of COVID, that is the story that we'll see. And that is true for any kind of media, and that is true for any kind of fact. You know, if it's not surprising, then why would anybody bother to tell us? So we really need to be on the lookout for that.
And the other thing, and this, I see this in politics all the time, and when I was a political consultant, I would always tell candidates, do not overextrapolate from the anecdotal. You're going to come back and you're going to tell me that I went to this event, I spoke to 100 people, everybody loved me, this is going so well. And you're taking that 100 people and you're spreading around the reaction you got in that room in your presence to, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people who you're not going to meet, who you're not going to have that opportunity to who won't have that one-on-one opportunity, whose feedback you haven't gotten yet. You're saying, well, it went so well at that event, it's going so well at these events, it must be, you know, a wildfire spreading throughout the particular district. And, you know, it often turns out not to be the case because you're using your experience to make wild generalizations.
Yeah, it's not only the people that you've met and you've seen their reaction, not only is that a small percentage of all the people in the area, but it's also they're not the same as all the other people because they're the ones who decided to come to your event. Right. And they're the ones who've had the chance to see your amazing political rhetoric. So it's so easy to fool ourselves. One of the challenges that I describe in the book is the challenge of combining that statistical perspective with your personal experience, because personal experience is, you know, it's not to be dismissed. When you go and you meet the vote as a politician, you go and meet the voters, you do learn stuff. You're going to get much more information, much more detailed information than you'd get from looking at a graph about polling. But the polling data is more representative. So it's not an easy task to combine the two. But that's where the real wisdom comes, the statistics plus the personal. Put them together, and you might start to actually make the world make sense.
Although it would help to have some basic math skills, too. So when you know, some study comes out that says people who ate this or drank that have a 42% higher risk of developing prostate cancer. They said, well, okay, 42% more than what? You know, so go back to give me the original data set, and you're saying that the chance of developing prostate cancer for this particular cohort is 1%, and the people who ate this or drank that have a 42% more likelihood of developing prostate cancer starting off that baseline. So you went from 1% chance to 1.42% chance. You don't have a 42% chance of getting prostate cancer, but people don't process that. A lot of people don't process it that way.
It's a shame because a good journalist or a good communicator would actually express that in a different way. They'd say, look, of 1,000 people, 10 got prostate cancer, but out of 1,000 people who drank coffee or whatever it is, they got prostate cancer. I mean, these are not the real numbers, but
right.
That sort of presentation, if anybody can understand that, it's not even a super complex piece of math to change one into another. But I just think we don't instinctively do that. Journalists aren't trained to communicate like that. And we as consumers of the news won't necessarily think things that way. But it's not, I mean, this is not super hard stuff.
No, it isn't.
It's just high school math.
But you're right. The reporting and the way we talk about it doesn't provide any context or consequence. So it's just numbers being thrown around. Then people start to dismiss everything, as you were sort of implying, everything that runs counter to their understanding of a particular event or dynamic, rather than digging deeper to be able to respond to what they're hearing and be able to, first understand what's actually going on and then respond to the erroneous things they're hearing.
Yeah, context is the word you used. It's so important. In fact, I sometimes use the three C's. So calm, as we discussed, just keep your cool. Then context, just where does this piece of information fit in? Can I compare it to something else to help me make sense of it? And then the final thing is curiosity. Rather than just saying, hey, this headline proves I was right, or this headline is something I'm going to use as a weapon in an argument, to say, this headline's interesting. I want to find out more. I want to dig a little bit deeper, a couple of extra Google searches, read to the second paragraph. Calm, context, curiosity. It's not about the spreadsheets. It's not about advanced math. Those simple questions are really going to help you make sense of the information that is presented to you on a daily basis.
And another way to talk about context, too, it's sort of the handle I think you use. It's just like, get the backstory. Like, you read a story, something occurred, or people are arguing this. What's the backstory on that? Where does this come from? You trace it back a little bit, and it probably would open up your understanding of what's happening.
Yeah, so often we treat these numbers as though they just kind of descended from some big spreadsheet in the sky and just kind of landed in the middle of a news bulletin or on the front page of a newspaper or on our Facebook feed. And we don't say, well, hang on, where did that come from? And I don't mean that in a really suspicious way, like, oh, that must be some propaganda. But just like, oh, that's interesting. Where did the number come from? I wonder how they discovered that. I'd like to know a little bit more. Just show an interest. The world's a really interesting place. And when you start viewing it like that, the whole process of consuming information just becomes more rewarding and I think just a little bit less stressful.
Yeah, well, the problem is members of the media benefit from crisis. So if they see something that could be a headline to scare people, they're going to grab it. And they don't care about attribution.
I think that's true. And also, things go, even when things are going well, they tend to go well slowly and they tend to go bad quickly. So there's always a systematic bias in like a daily news show. It's always about the stuff that's gone wrong. And if you actually took a step back, I talk about this in the book. If you think about like what the news might look like if the newspapers came out only every 25 years, you might go, actually, the last 25 years, maybe not so bad. I mean, some bad times, but some good times as well. But day by day, it's very hard for anything really nice to happen. It's very easy for something bad to happen.
Tim Harford, award-winning columnist, broadcaster, and economist, international best-selling author of The Undercover Economist. Most recently, what we've been discussing, The Data Detective, 10 Easy Rules to Make Sense of Statistics, which is now available. So pick it up. Tim, thanks for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Oh, thanks so much. My pleasure.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
FYI, I've got something to tell you ASAP.
Uh-oh.
Acronyms are white supremacist.
What?
Comes to us from our betters at San Francisco, the school board that took down Lincoln's name. They're not going to use the acronym VAPA anymore. Visual,
I don't even know what that means.
Visual and Performing Arts for their arts department. Okay. Instead, it will be called the SFUSD Arts Department. I don't know how to break it to him, but SFUSD is, in fact, an acronym for San Francisco Unified School District. But apparently VAPA is white supremacist and SFUSD is not white supremacist.
More BTW or FYI.
The director of the arts department there, Sam Bass, love his work. Acronyms are a symptom of white supremacy culture. We are prioritizing anti-racist arts instruction in our work. It's a very simple step we can take to just be referred to as the SFSD Arts Department, SFSD Art Department, for families to better understand who we are. Oh, it's very helpful.
Well, that's going to make a big difference, yeah.
The use of so many acronyms within the educational field often tends to alienate those who may not speak English to understand the acronym. So, no more acronyms. We got some work to do in the military where everything is an acronym, but okay. That's all part of white supremacy culture, so acronyms are out in the brave new America.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Guess the final score of this Sunday's big game, and you could win $50,000. Enter today at 560theanswer.com/score.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and the more ridiculous the finger-pointing, the better. And so Mayor Triple Threat has another Dem socialist politician who can't seem to move beyond the Trump era. And
yeah, I mean,
so he's so convenient to blame for all that ails Chicago.
Yeah, he's the reason why, Dan, and his lack of a vaccination plan, that there's a standoff between the CTU and the CPS, don't you know?
So look, this is a very difficult situation, and we're in it still because of the incompetence of the previous administration. So I think it's important for both sides to come to the table in good faith, recognize that we're both trying to work through a very challenging situation, but we must get a deal done.
Yeah, and this cooling off period, by the way, ends today. Tomorrow, we don't know. Are kids going to be, e-learning from home? Or are the computers going to be shut down because she keeps caving to the CTU?
Yeah.
I know it's getting, it's just cumbersome. It's boring. I understand.
I'll tell you what. I said this, had the chance to interview Bob Mazakowski the other day, Chicago Hope Academy founder, West Side. Few people have more street cred than Bob Mazakowski. And as soon as they erect a statue of Bob Mazakowski on the west side of Chicago, then I'll start believing there's anybody in this city who's serious, anybody in a position of authority in the system who's serious about educating children. Until then, just spare me. Honestly, just spare me. It's a joke.
Yeah, they don't care. CTU, they don't care about our kids, you know that. And it's, I mean, where's Dr. Jill Biden in all this, the educator that she is? Why isn't she coming in to help us? Where are the Obamas Chicago kids?
What do they have to do with anything? This is a local matter. You've lost control of your school system. Why is it our problem?
Because they're the leaders. They should care about our kids. I just think that they should get involved, don't you? I mean, nothing's working. We're just sitting here twiddling our thumbs, waiting on pins and needles to see, because we can't start sports. Even though we're in phase four, because there's fighting among the leadership, the CTU and the CPS. They want more vaccines. They want, but then we're going to give them a vaccine and then they're going to want something else. And that's what Lori Lightfoot does not realize, that they're extortionists. And when extortionists gain ground every day, they're going to keep asking for more and more and more. And I bet they'll stop when they want hazard pay. I'm sure that's going to be next. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Naomi in Norwood Park.
Hi. About the Kamala and her ex or her husband or whatever he is.
Dougie.
Yeah, Dougie. What kind of a name even is that? But
that's her pet name for him.
It's cute.
Yeah.
Dougie.
The Valentine's, I was taking a shower, I hop out of the shower, you said those Valentine's, I puked all over myself, and then I took another shower.
Yeah, I know, that'll happen. You have to be careful. You have to, thanks for the call, Naomi. You have to, listen closely to what we're talking about in this show. It could get pretty gamey. Dave in Downers Grove.
Yeah, Dan and Amy, I don't understand. I've been mentioning this many times. Why aren't we going to technology to phase out some of these teachers? McDonald's does it. They're going with the
kiosk. Yeah.
And Amazon does it. Why aren't we using the technology we have? And I've mentioned this before, open communication with a live screen in each classroom. One teacher teaches each class, 10 classes, with teacher's aides in the room. I don't understand why we're not using our technology against these hostage takers of our kids.
Well, thanks for the call, Dave. First of all, you can't replace the kind of interpretive dancing that we've seen the dance instructors in CPS online. You also can't replace the sort of authentic expression through song that we've heard from the CPS Yeah, CTU choir, choir directors online as well. So that's number one. Number two, you could say the same thing about the personnel that work for the Chicago Transit Authority, too, couldn't you, that work for Metra. Why doesn't anybody get laid off? Why doesn't anybody get replaced? What do you mean?
I mean, there's trains with no people. There's buses that are empty.
You're starting from the premise that those in charge of the system are trying to operate it efficiently rather than the system is a patronage dumping ground to use as a political foundation for public office. So how can you live in Chicago or Illinois and not understand that? I guess I was ahead of my time when I ran a statewide campaign saying that Illinois isn't broken, it's fixed. I remember getting a lot of heads nodding when I would tell people that 10 years later, and people still don't get it. Why aren't they doing something that's sensible to me? Because it's not sensible to them, because they have different ends than you have. That's not obvious to you? Is that not obvious to some people? It clearly isn't. How is that possible? You have to be willfully blind. You have to have lobotomized yourself with a spoon to, and I don't mean to be insulting, but I guess I'm going to be, to ask questions like, why don't they do this and why don't they do that? Obvious things that anybody who is interested in educating children would do. And obvious things that anybody who is interested in balancing a budget would do. Why don't they do those obvious things? Because they don't know what they're doing, or they do know what they're doing? Because it's broken or it's fixed. Amazing to me how many people, including center-right people who listen to this show, commonsensical people, commonsensocrats, to borrow from Scott Shalady, you don't see the thing for what it is? Well, that's why you can't unfix it, to continue with my vernacular, because you don't even see what it is. You just throw up your hand. Here, Lori Lightfoot should fire everybody. Why would she do that? She's not going to do that. That's not in her interest. This person should do that, and that person should do this. So why don't they? Because they don't see something that a grade schooler could see? No. Because their interests are being served by the way things are. For goodness sakes. You want to know why people like me, who put in 25 years fighting this thing, are frustrated and exasperated and not inclined to the mindless happy talk that some people expect and apparently enjoy from these political hacks wandering around this region, is because there's just no penetrating the consciousness of this electorate, it seems. I said it at the beginning of the show. There is actually a revolt going on in California. California! Where they have great weather all year round and they could just enjoy life and ignore politics. And just, California, there is a revolt going on. There is a grassroots, unpaid effort to get the 1.5 million signatures to put Gavin Newsom up for recall by March 17th. They're on that clock. There's a former mayor of San Diego has raised $1 million. He's holding himself out as a candidate. There are Democrats saying this is real because there are independents, Democrats, Republicans all saying Gavin Newsom is a problem here. What he's done and how he's managed this is unacceptable. They're upset. Here? What do you got?
And now we're hearing rumblings that Mayor Lightfoot might shut down TVs at all bars and restaurants on Super Bowl Sunday. My friend owns a bar, called me yesterday and said somebody from her office said just be prepared for that to happen. And he said, well, I already, you know, prepackaged Super Bowl viewing parties. And he said, well, then, and if you don't comply, you'll get a fine. So it's ridiculous. This big government, again. And nobody care. Like, is anybody care?
And so what's he going to do, your friend?
He's going to stay open.
Right.
Come and get me has always been his approach.
The real approach going on here, generally speaking, is perhaps most accurately described in Václav Havel's The Power of the Powerless. Something else that, I don't know, other people that our listeners listen to, you may want to test them to see if they've ever read a fracking book who know a thing of what they're talking about. Or they're just repeating lines they heard on Hannity's program. Goodness sakes, the mind-numbing nonsense you hear from people on our side. So unhelpful. Václav Havel's Power of the Powerless, The Greengrocer. Why does the greengrocer put up the display Workers of the World Unite in his shop because he's participating in the charade. As Havel said, he's not going to put up a sign, "I'm afraid and therefore astonishingly obedient, nor will the powers that be force him to." They don't want to embarrass or shame him. To overcome the complication, his expression of loyalty must take the form of a sign, which, at least on its textual surface, indicates a level of disinterested conviction. It must allow the greengrocer to say, "What's wrong with the workers of the world uniting?" Right? That's a nice thing. "What's wrong with stay safe?" That's a nice thing. "I'm being nice. I'm being considerate to my neighbor." The sign helps the greengrocer conceal from himself the low foundations of his obedience, at the same time concealing the low foundations of power. It hides behind the facade of something high, and that something is ideology. The presentation is, I'm doing something good. Workers uniting, yay. Staying safe, good. Something high, but in fact it's something low. It's your obsequious obedience to nonsense and the low foundations of the power your overlords exercise over you. People don't get this, really. Chris and Carrie.
Hey, good morning, guys. I always preface my phone calls by saying my wife is a teacher, but she came from the private sector, changed her career, and now in the public sector, and she bangs her head against the wall almost daily. So part of the problem, when you look at these individually, they may not seem like much, but when taken as a whole, they add up. So in reference to your guys that we had on yesterday, we're running for 214 board, and wasteful spending, I think, was part of their complaint, is we see it every day, not only in my kids' school district, but my wife's school district, where she teaches. You have a superintendent who, no offense to gym teachers out there, but are typically the gym teachers because the males can go back to school and finish the doctorate and then become superintendents, make the decisions. They change curriculum constantly. So they're spending 100, 300 grand every couple of years to change curriculum. We see a lot of it in our school district. Oh my gosh, Barrington just changed their curriculum. Look what they're doing. We got to change to what Barrington's doing. Barrington must be doing something, you know, better. Barrington's going, oh my gosh, look what Lake Forest or Highland Park is doing. We got to change the curriculum. So it trickles down that everybody's trying to copy each other. So now that's new textbooks. And there's a company out there, I think it's called Pearson. Pearson creates the textbooks and all the stuff you need for your curriculum. And if you look back at the new curriculum, it's not much different than it was, let's say, 6 or 8 years ago. It's just a constant cycle of spend money and change curriculum when no one really takes a look at that curriculum and sees what's different about it. It's like maybe
there's some things different about it. Black Lives Matter Week, there's some things different about the curriculum. No question about that. The rewriting of history that's going on, the infusion of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. I mean, that's already been a staple. But, I mean, it's getting further and further left is my point. More and more identitarian. So there's some things changing. I take your point about follow the leader. But there's some things changing. It's going harder and harder left at your expense.
Exactly. Then you get the director of curriculum who goes in and gets that position and then goes and gets her doctorate on your back and then jumps ship for a different school district or goes and teaches at a college. So, again, individually may not seem like much, but when added up as a whole, it's mind-dumbing.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Rob in Ukrainian Village.
Hey, back in November, December, when Christmas shopping, I used to jokingly sign my online reviews as being located in the Soviet Socialist Republic of Chicago, and it's becoming more and more true, unfortunately, every day. But I guess every week that passes, we become number one in something else. I heard today that Orkin released that Chicago's number one in bed bugs. We've been number one in rats, shootings, violence, murder, carjackings. Riding the train isn't safe anymore. Our schools aren't worth squat. So, the downward spiral is on its way. So congratulations, Chicago politicians. You've done us a good job.
Thanks for the call, Rob.
Next Detroit.
Whatever happened to the Rona Busters, those superheroes?
Oh, yeah. They're supposed to save the day.
So the superheroes that we have in charge, remember them playing dress-up, Triple Threat and her sidekick, they couldn't overcome the villain, Trump? Did anybody ask that follow-up yesterday? Steve
She's
on the south
CNN.
Side.
She won't talk to parents. She just talks to CNN and MSNBC.
It's good enough for Chicago. Hey. Steve on the south side.
Good morning. Good morning. I was listening to you talk, Dan, and it's like the irony is lost. We've got idiot parents that are following loser politicians that fail in everything they do, and they can only work in the public sector, but yet they're ceding power of their children to these idiots and expecting a different outcome. It's like, really? Should you even be a parent if you can't control your kid's destiny? If you're placing it in these losers' hands, what kind of a parent are you? I don't get it. And then they expect something different.
Thanks for the call, Steve. Don in Bloomingdale.
You know, Dan, you asked what's going on with the electorate in Chicago. They're very concerned about getting shot, getting carjacked, can't ride the train like your previous caller said. I think they're a little preoccupied with what's going on around them just to stay alive rather than their kids' school, but it's a shame.
All right, thanks, Don. Deborah in Arlington Heights.
Morning. When I was a kid in the 60s and 70s going to school, we lived in Chicago, and I went to Catholic school, and my parents couldn't afford it anymore, so they switched me to public school. And even back then, we were way ahead of the curriculum that the public school was teaching. We had learned it a year or more before. Plus, I couldn't believe, even as a child, what a free-for-all it was because we were very regimented, which wasn't a bad thing, by the way.
Thanks for the call, Deborah. By the way, just on that score, empowerillinois.org, where tax credit scholarships up to $13,000, $26,000 if you have unique needs, available for private schools. $13,000 and $26,000. And then there's this also, too, to make more scholarships available. A group of donors in the Archdiocese of Chicago have banded together to offer a 2-to-1 match on any donations made to Empower Illinois, as long as they're earmarked for Catholic schools in the Archdiocese of Chicago by the end of, this is good through the end of February. So, in other words, a $500 donation for scholarships at a school would be triple to $1,500. EmpowerIllinois.org. They're doing a 2-for-1 match. Chicago Catholic schools and the Archdiocese of Chicago's. If you want to feel like you're doing something that actually matters to a kid, Rob in Hampshire.
Hey Dan and Amy, how are you doing this morning?
Good.
All right.
Hey, I'm out in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, and it's just as ridiculous, and the mask nonsense is just as bad out here as it is in Chicago. I took my two boys out of school and took them skiing for a couple days on the mountain all day yesterday. Everywhere, outside, mask up.
Masks on Everybody the mountain? People are skiing in masks?
Yeah, we heard from Andy in Hinsdale about to Jackson Hole, snowboarding, same thing. In Wyoming.
You're in line, and I'm a 59-year-old guy, we ski once a year. You're at an altitude of 10,000 feet. You are sucking wind for oxygen. Mm-hmm. And this guy walks up to you in a security thing and says, mask up, over your nose. Get that mask over your nose.
Oh, I'm like,
there's nobody around.
Next time, could ask him if he could administer an anal swab just out of an abundance of caution.
Well, I offered administer one to him with my ski pole.
All right. Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it. Sean from Elmwood Park.
Oh, Sean.
Masks on the Mountain is a great name for a strip joint. I'm copywriting that son of a gun in an hour.
Yes, you are.
Listen, I got to tell you, I just got back to the sewer about 7-8 hours ago. And, Dan, you know how many people are from Illinois in Naples. But on this particular trip, I also had to go to the other side. I am not kidding you when I tell you that virtually, I would say 50% of the tables, you know, I like to eat by myself, table for one, please.
Yeah.
They're talking about the sewer of Chicago. I'm not even kidding you. And this new story, or it's not that it's new. It's the same rinse and repeat story with the Potemkin argument between the mayor and the union. they are leading their news off, Prof, with this. We are truly. The slogan is "Go back, I dare you," because there's so many Illinoisans there. It is just a real joke, and the only ones that can't seem to see it are the Illinois Republicans. Because where's Durkin? You got the donut crust on your shirt. Fetzo, what do you do all day? What do you do all day? Call your brother? How's the money raising going? Scumbags. The only thing worse than the Democrats are the Republicans in Illinois.
Thanks, Sean. Candace in Mount Pleasant.
Good morning. Hey, Dan. Yesterday, Franklin Graham on Gab was talking about how Boston hospitals are ready to, they're complaining and they're ready to start letting families back in and, you know, with their loved ones. And it made me think about you and your dog and how much you love your dog. And could you possibly let your dog have surgery without you or be put to sleep? And I thought, you know, if everything that's going on right now were our dogs and not our kids and our family, I don't think we would have put up with it. I think it would have been over with a long time ago.
All right. Thanks for the call, Candace. My dog does have power of attorney over me. So,
oh, that's right.
He will make the decision on pulling the plug.
Yeah, I watched him sign the papers.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.